chimeras come to life. The Oklahoma City Thunder are one win away from becoming NBA champions. All of this before the Seattle Supersonics return to their rightful home in Seattle. I will say this, I was able to enjoy that game more than I thought I would be able to because I did my quote-unquote grieving after game four. Pacers blew game four, and anybody with a brain knew that they were dead. They were dead heading to Oklahoma City for game five. It was the reality of the situation. They had an opportunity. They had the Thunder on the ropes, and they let him off the hook. And it's as simple as that. And what a performance by the Oklahoma City Thunder. There's a moment in that game where T.J. McConnell comes in. He provides this incredible lift in the third quarter, and it's like they're keeping it close. They're keeping it close, and you're wondering, hey, do the Pacers have one more of these gutsy comebacks in them? Do they have another one of these magical Pacers in the clutch? Are they going to reverse the script on the Thunder, who maybe you're a little asleep at the wheel? They got a bunch of possessions where Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's out. All of a sudden, they start to go on a run. All of a sudden, what was at one point a 15-point game turns into a 2-point game. And I'm going, whoa. They really might. Oh, no. Oh, boom, 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 boom. It's over. And you know why it's over? Because of Oklahoma City's DNA. Who they are as a team showed up exactly the way that they needed it in their most critical moment. And that was their pressure defensively, their ability to turn the ball over, and man, oh man, tough finish for Andrew Nembhard, Tyrese Haliburton, and the Indiana Pacers, who could just not deal with that ball pressure that realistically only the Oklahoma City Thunder can replicate right now in the NBA. The set of guards that they have, the point of attack defensive players that they have are completely unmatched. And then, of course, just the shot making of Jalen Williams and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who combined for 70 points. And that's really the takeaway from this game is simply that. It's that this is the game where those two guys fully arrived. Shai has been brilliant this entire postseason. He was incredible throughout this entire series. But how many possessions in that game was he draped by a defender? Did you think, oh, okay, this is a tough shot. Oh boy, this is a difficult look. And he was getting to his spots and just knocking down everything from the mid-range. And then he's got his partner in crime, Jalen Williams, who finishes with 40 points, more points than Shai, hitting threes, getting to the basket, looking like just a bowling ball down the lane. Could not be stopped. Would not be stopped. Going through defenders, over defenders. It didn't matter. Those two guys, that was a, hey, welcome to NBA lore moment. There's no more, hey, these guys are young. Hey, these guys have a lot of time on their side. Hey, is Jalen Williams going to look tight in these big games, which is what happened last year, which is what happened a couple of times in the Denver series? Hey, are these guys ready to be NBA champions? Do the Pacers, despite not being exactly like, the LeBron Cleveland Cavaliers, who's going to the finals every year, but a team with more playoff experience, a team with Pascal Siakam, a team with Miles Turner, like real longtime vets. Hey, are they going to be able to? Oh yeah, they overcame it. They overcame it. And I got to admit, I felt like I was watching something special. And I don't think that they're going anywhere. I do think one thing has become apparent from this finals outside of that, which is Lu Dort, the Montreal native. There was some discussion about this is just the way it is in the second apron era, and this is our obsessive era about what teams look like in the future, that he would be a guy that gets moved eventually in a trade because they can replace him with young, cheap talent. And it's actually something that I've discussed about why I think the Thunder team is so sustainable. Is like, hey, not only are they good now, but they have all these assets, which they don't need to use to push in for a trade to add some superstar. All these assets are going to give them the ability to continue to replenish young talent and not have to give up on their core guys. I think Lu Dort has established himself as a core guy. He's just spectacular defensively. Tyrese Halliburton's going to take a lot of bullets over the next, I would say, 48 hours up until the next game. I don't know, the leg injury, and he had to go to the tunnel, but it didn't look all that compromised to me, if I'm just being honest. It seemed like more of an NBA injury than an NHL injury. Let's put it that way. He had what's got to be one of the worst finals performances by a star player that you're ever going to see, across from the two guys, his counterparts, having the best games. The only difference is, and credit to Andrew Nembhard, he digs in defensively. He does his absolute best. Nesmith fouls everybody, but at least he gets into you. Siakam was brilliant defensively throughout that basketball game. I think that he is somehow still one of the more underrated defensive players in the NBA, but there's just nothing like what the Pacers had to deal with, what Tyrese Halliburton had to deal with Lu Dort, where it's just a physical freak who can push you 5 feet back of the three-point line and just hounds you all game long. And then whenever you get the switch, boom, there's Alex Caruso on you. There's Jalen Williams on you. It's a tall order for Tyrese Halliburton. He's not a scorer in the way that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is, and he's not a scorer in the way that Jalen Williams is. But the one thing about him that I do think deserves criticism from this game is that when you're a creator, you need to be able to beat your man from the point of the attack. You need to be able to force the double to come. You've got to make the defense collapse to you. And Halliburton, all game long, was kind of trying to dance above that three-point line, where he's not Steph Curry. He's not able to extend that range 4 or 5 feet back and have you feel really confident in it. But also just his ball handling and his first step, his ability to just like blow by an elite defender, we haven't seen all that much of it throughout the entirety of this series. And this has been kind of my criticism moving throughout the playoffs. And I've been kind of reluctant to do so because nobody saw the Pacers getting here. But when they get in their half-court sets, the Pacers just don't have a guy that can consistently break down a good defense. That's not who Nembhard is. He's getting to tough spots and he's having to make tough shots. Siakam can do it, but we've seen it. It's that first dribble for Siakam, that move where he's trying to penetrate. He's more of a perimeter guy that will float to the outside and try to flip that ball up. And then without Halliburton, and like, again, TJ McConnell was their best player in this game outside of Siakam. Like, the by not even close. I don't even know who, like, maybe Nesmith? But McConnell came in, and what was he doing? He was attacking matchups. He's getting into the paint, and he's tiny, but he was getting to some areas and getting foul calls and getting in the lane, and all that was the one time where the Thunder looked vulnerable, and Tyrese Halliburton just didn't give him any of that. Anyway, the real story is Shai and Jalen Williams, who, again, now when we're going to be doing, they have the real potential to go down as an all-time duo. Like, are they going to be Shaq and Kobe? No. Are they going to be MJ and Pippen? No. But if you look at their age, the landscape of the Western Conference, and what they're already accomplishing and the way that they're accomplishing it, it's difficult for me to predict that these guys aren't going to be in Western Conference finals for the next 6-7 years. Like, that these guys are going to, hey, the West is going to run through these two players. They've got to keep them together. And yeah, things can happen in the second apron and all this different stuff, the parity era and injury. Like, there are all these variables that are out there. But you look at the two of them in a game like this and how difficult it is for a deep team like the Pacers with multiple guys that they could throw at this team. Like, the Pacers are running how many guys out there? Shepherd, Mathurin, McConnell, Nembhard, Halliburton, Nesmith, Siakam. Like, that's seven right there, different looks that they're giving those two guards, and they're just finding ways through it every single time. So that was the real takeaway to me, is as a guy who talked about how I wasn't feeling the weight of this finals, that the ring didn't feel big enough, and that I wasn't sure what the storylines were going to be, and hey, doesn't it feel a little too early for these two? The way that they played in that game five was holy crap. I obviously knew these guys were good. I knew that this team was, what, 68 wins? They've had an incredible season. But this was just a real eye-opening game of just where those two guys are at, how much they've evolved now through these two playoff runs that they've had in back-to-back seasons. And what their futures can be and how this really does feel like we're just scratching the surface of something extremely special. Okay, so that brings me to this. Yeah, the finals happened, and I led with it because I care about it, and I thought it was an interesting game, and I think that the Thunder and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Jalen Williams, they deserve that respect. But if we're being honest right now with what the NBA discourse is, the things that people find most interesting, and I get it, this is a Canadian show, a Toronto show, so there's going to be a hyper-locality with the Toronto Raptors specifically. But is that it's the NBA Finals, and we're having way more discourse about player movement. We just had a trade. I talked about it yesterday. The Desmond Bain deal. He goes to Orlando. It's for first round picks. It's a pick swap. It's a roster piece. We're debating and discussing what now is going to happen with the Memphis Grizzlies. But the last, I would say, week, what do you think there's been more of? Kevin Durant dialogue or NBA Finals dialogue? And yes, part of this is because we're in a weird place with the NBA where a lot of people my age have grown up on these stars. We're seeing these stars like Steph Curry and LeBron James and Kevin Durant all extend their careers to places that is not normal for the NBA. We've never had this before. Like, it used to be one guy, Karl Malone, who was like played until he was 40 and he was effective for a very long time. This was not the norm by any stretch of the imagination. LeBron is still one of the best players in the NBA at 40 freaking years old. We've grown accustomed to him being the centerpiece of discussion in the NBA. And that only got supersized by the fact that he was in Los Angeles. But we've got these aging stars that still the narratives circulate around. And we haven't gotten used to the world of, well, who's next? Because it's like, oh, is it Tatum? Is it Brown? Is it going to be the Celtics team? All right, now it looks like this Oklahoma City team. Jokic seems to be for the NBA nerds, but does not seem to resonate all that much with the greater NBA casual Twitter or fan base at large. Luka Doncic, obviously, there was a lot of upheaval with this season. He had this incredible run last year, but also a polarizing player. I know the face of the league conversation is very tiring. I don't think that you need a face, but there hasn't been, I would say, the connectivity yet to the new generation of player. And that's why this finals represented something that I think was exciting for the NBA, is because there was an opportunity here to now really sell you on Tyrese Halliburton and Jalen Williams and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Look, this is the league's MVP, who was the runner-up the year before, and now he's in the NBA Finals doing his thing. Get to know him. Get used to this. I think that pivot's going to happen. But you have an offseason where you've got the third best player potentially in the NBA, or maybe the second. I don't know, depending on how you feel about it. The second or the third best player in the NBA, and Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's in trade rumors. You've got Kevin Durant, who's in trade rumors. You've got all these teams here locally, the Toronto Raptors, buzzing around of, hey, they're interested in these trades. And it has felt to me anyways as though the league has become one where we're talking more about transactions than we are about gameplay. And it's always been a league where we've been interested in transactions. Like, let's not pretend as though this hasn't been the case years with LeBron. Like, yeah, I was there. I watched LeBron lose when he was in Cleveland, his final year in the first go-around and in the second go-around, I guess. And both of those playoff rounds were surrounded by, hey, LeBron could leave. LeBron, what's the decision? And then, hey, he's definitely going to LA. His kid's already in school in LA. This is a done deal. It's going to happen, blah, 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 blah. We had it to a smaller degree, I want to say, but with Kawhi Leonard here of, yeah, the Raptors are in the finals, but what's Kawhi going to do after this year? Like, don't forget how big of a conversation that was during the Philly series. I think it quieted down as it went on, but during the Philly series specifically, all we were talking about in Toronto was, hey, no one's helping Kawhi, but also, is he going to leave now? And if he wins this game, that being game seven, will he stay? So this has always been a part of the NBA. I'm not trying to pretend like this is like some new phenomenon that all of a sudden we care about transactions. Yeah, no. I get it. We've always cared about the transactions. But, and maybe part of this is that it's moving a little bit more online for everybody. So we're trapped more by the Twitter stuff than by watching shows or by consuming a lot of this through podcasts. But I have not felt in my immediate circle, and even with NBA fans that I know, like diehard NBA fans, that they are nearly as compelled by this finals as they are with where is Kevin Durant going to go? What insider do you want to hear from talk about Kevin Durant? Even yesterday during like the finals coverage, a lot of it is like, here's Shams Charania to talk about the potential. Here's Amon Shumpert to talk about where he thinks Kevin Durant should go. It's a little outsized compared to what we've seen in the past. And part of that, again, is the mixture of the two teams that are in the finals and the names that are out there. But I do wonder if this is just like the way that this is going to continue to trend, which is that the league continues to be more about the stories and the transactions and the drama than it is about the gameplay and the guys who are actually participating in its biggest moments, or if this is something that does dissipate in the parody era as we start to see, I don't know, maybe some of these younger stars emerge as more consistent championship level players. The other part of it, too, is that in this parody era, which I don't think this part of it should be overlooked, is when every team feels like they can be the Pacers, right? When you see this turnover in champions and you look at it and you go, okay, there's no Golden State. Okay, there's no LeBron to go through in the East, where everybody feels like they have a chance, it boosts the hunger by fan bases to make these aggressive trades, to go like, well, why can't we be the Orlando Magic? Look at how people are talking about them all of a sudden. This Orlando Magic team that has done diddly squat. Yeah, I like Paolo Banchero. I like Franz Wagner. Okay, sure. There's no proof of concept with these guys. It's similar to the stuff that's going on with the Raptors right now, where people are like, man, could you imagine if the Raptors were the added Giannis? I'm like, okay, yeah, but what certainty does he have that this is working? There's no base here that's gone on deep playoff runs and feels like, oh boy, if they could just add a Giannis. Like, people talk about the Kawhi trade. The Raptors were a 55, they were winning a ton of games every single year, year over year over year before they made that move. And they didn't have to remove all that much from their championship caliber, or sorry, their high-end Eastern Conference playoff roster in order to acquire him. It's a lot different when we're talking about like, hey, give up four first-round picks with Desmond Bane for an Orlando Magic team that hasn't got it in the first round. Hey, give up everything for Giannis. Give up your entire draft future for Giannis so that he could even potentially play next to Scottie Barnes. There's no proof of concept there. You have no idea what they're entering into, especially in this reality where it's like Brandon Ingram. So it's very different now in terms of the way that we're going to be looking at trades. It used to be that you had to build out and you built something, you built a strong foundation, and then you started to look at things like the Masai big Kawhi swing. Then you started to look at things and go, okay, well, we figured out that now we've accumulated all these assets and we've got these good players. Now it's like, hey, we've got a couple of young stars or we got a couple of pieces that we think we like. We should be moving all in. We should be getting these pieces. We should be attacking a window here, the parity window. So yeah, I just think that what we're seeing is something that is not likely to go away in the near future. And that is, it's a league that has already been trending this way. Of course, again, the decision being sort of the real moment that you could probably or would point to of, hey, this is when it really started to tilt in terms of our interest in where free agents or where trades were going to happen. But they did try to design this league as one where it was like, okay, well, we're going to try to limit the player transaction with this luxury tax. That was part of this deal. Was the second apron wasn't only to prevent teams from just outspending others the way that Golden State was. It was supposed to be a mechanism to make sure that we avoided stuff like Kevin Durant signing in Golden State in the first place, or try to give these small markets advantages in terms of keeping their players. And yeah, trades are more difficult, but it seems like we're talking about it more than ever. That brings me to the Toronto Raptors. Okay, this has been a long rant, but the Raptors have been one of the teams that have been most discussed when it's come to all of these trades. Giannis Antetokounmpo's out there. Guess who gets linked to him? Kevin Durant is out there, and they're viewed as a team that is quote-unquote lurking in the Kevin Durant sweepstakes, despite the fact that KD is seemingly unwilling to come here. Raptors fans are going, well, it could be like Kawhi, except for, again, Kawhi came to a team that was built to win a championship. I still don't understand the vision of Scottie Barnes, Brandon Ingram, Grady Dick, and Kevin Durant at age 37. Forgive me. I'll be happy to be wrong if they are in the Eastern Conference Final next year and we're going, these guys could actually win. I will be the first. I don't understand it at all. I really don't. The Raptors have been a notoriously quiet organization in terms of not letting their business get out there. They act swiftly. They act in the shadows. And now all of a sudden it's like there's all this stuff about them. So I don't know. I don't know what to believe with this stuff, but I do trust a lot of these reporters. And this was the latest from Jake Fisher. Quote, the Raptors are reportedly open to trading RJ Barrett, Emmanuel Quickley, and Jakob Poeltl. Sources say that the Raptors would be willing to part with either of those players for significant roster upgrades. Several league figures with knowledge of the Raptors' thinking have likewise asserted that they could show a willingness to move center Jakob Poeltl as well, provided that the trade in question brought back Kevin Durant. Okay, so there's a few things here. One, I think that there's a part of this that is Phoenix is not getting the trade offers that they like. It's been rumored now for a little while that Minnesota, despite his reluctance to go there, still has the best trade package on the table because it's Rudy Gobert and Dante DiVincenzo, which if you're asking me personally in a trade for Phoenix, if I was a Suns fan, I wouldn't be like, holy cow, we could get Dante DiVincenzo and Rudy Gobert? Boy, oh boy, we got to do that. That's like the least exciting trade ever, is getting those two guys. And I like DiVincenzo, and Rudy Gobert had some real moments in the playoffs, and I know they've got Devin Booker, so they might not want to just completely tear that down. Ugh, no thanks. If you're the Rockets, you're sitting there and you're going, why do we have to give up A++ assets? If that's the counter, we'll give you one good young player, but why would we give you your draft pick back? That's a crazy good asset compared to Rudy Gobert and Dante DiVincenzo and even the Raptors deal. It's like, what would you rather have? Emmanuel Quickley, just from an asset, pure asset standpoint, Emmanuel Quickley making $35 million or a future unprotected Suns pick that looks as though it could absolutely be in the lottery. That's not a difficult prediction to make. Yeah, you're kind of playing chicken with this. I saw Kirk Goldsberry mention that the Spurs were inquired about the number two pick for KD. And yeah, you got to ask and Stephon Castle. But if you're the Spurs, you're going, are you out of your minds? There's absolutely no way. You know that Kevin Durant is unhappy, does not want to play for your organization, is turning 37 years old, right? Makes a ton of money and is a malcontent. It makes no sense. I don't understand how his value could be that high. People, I love, there was like this assertion by, don't be surprised if Kevin Durant goes for less than Desmond Bane. Like, yeah, Desmond Bane is young and in his prime. Kevin Durant is 37 years old and has just had multiple stops where he was unhappy. So I don't know what the landscape looks like for him. My guess is that he will find a way to end up in one of those two destinations, those Texas destinations that he covets. The Miami one also makes no sense to me. But yeah, the trade offers that are out there, they're not explosive. They're not incredible. And so I guess that's why the Raptors have been there. But I also think some of the reporting that has to do with the Raptors is like the way that they're leveraging Minnesota right now, which is, hey, if you don't up these offers, San Antonio and Houston, we will call the bluff of the player and the bluff of you, and we will trade him for what we think is our best basketball move. So you better give us something of consequence in a Kevin Durant trade. That's my personal read on this, not insider information. That right now the Toronto Raptors are being used as yet another leverage team to make sure that San Antonio and Houston don't feel like they're bidding against each other. That being said, I do believe the Raptors are very open for business. I do believe all the smoke about, hey, Masai is out there and he's looking to do something creative, and that the Raptors look at this window and are saying to themselves, hey, what else could we add for the pieces that we have? I went over this on yesterday's show, but yeah, part of it makes you a little upset. It does change the way I think we should perceive the Quickly and Barrett trade. Like, depending on what they're able to do with those two guys, if they were to package them up, but just the fact that the Raptors, without any competitive seasons after OG and Anunoby, are already looking at these two guys and saying, yeah, we would move them. Or Jakob Poeltl, who they traded a first-round pick for, they would go, yeah, we would move him. After being so staunch and not wanting to move Poeltl a year ago, I guess they didn't want to move him for draft picks to a contender or whatever, or a younger player, but it would be very strange to be saying Jakob Poeltl is going in a trade for Kevin Durant. Not as though Durant is not clearly the better player, but if you're saying what's the better fit, yeah, who's protecting the rim for the Raptors next year? Like, who's the center? Who's playing the five for the Toronto Raptors if they remove him and bring in Kevin Durant and have a defense that involves Brandon Ingram and 37-year-old KD? It doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm not on the Kevin Durant wagon. I don't think that a guy who doesn't want to come here and who's been pissed off and prickly about the last three situations he's been in should be like, oh, don't worry, we were able to settle Kawhi down. Kyle Lowry's not here. A young emerging Pascal Siakam's not here. Fred VanVleet's not here. This is not the same infrastructure in which Kevin Durant would be entering if you were to trade for him and he didn't want to be here. Anyway, that brings me to this. If you look at the betting odds right now for just about anybody, right? You go like, hey, John Morant, Mike, I traded. Where's he favored to go? Toronto's at the top. Kevin Durant is in the betting odds for the Toronto Raptors. The Toronto Raptors are there for him, sorry. Hey, go look at any major book and you want to place a bet. Raptors, Kevin Durant. See, there's some smoke there. You can place the odds. Domantas Sabonis. The Raptors are at the very top. Yes, part of this to me is just book manipulation where they're going, hey, the Raptors be rumored to do something. So we're not going to give crazy odds on this team acquiring these players. So part of it is just them making sure they don't get killed if the Raptors were to make one of these trades. But to me personally, it questions what the Raptors' plan is exactly and whether they actually have one. Do the Raptors really have a plan? Because, okay, Jake Fisher's putting it out there that they want to keep Brandon Ingram. Makes sense. They just traded for him. Scotty Barnes, makes sense, was rookie of the year, has been their franchise, the cornerstone piece, the guy that they've said they've been building around. And Grady Dick, another first-round pick who, yeah, makes sense in the three-point shooting era that you would want for a team that has not been able to find three-point shooters for the life of them for the last 5 years, would want to keep the guy that has improved off of his rookie year and look like a real steal at his draft slot and hits threes and can play without the basketball. Hey, nice to have one of those guys in a core with Brandon Ingram. I'm telling you, people are in for a rude awakening watching this guy play off the ball. So, okay. Is that the plan then? The plan is just if a guy becomes available, like a star, because if you're asking me personally, I'm not interested in Ja Morant. It's a huge name. People will get crazy excited for it if it ends up happening. But this is kind of what I'm speaking about when it comes to like our obsession with transactions versus the reality of the NBA. This is something that happened that I thought with the Brandon Ingram deal is, okay, it's a name. People know him. You can say all-star just like you can with Ja Morant. Ja Morant has flattened as a basketball player. He's missed a ton of time. He's been involved in controversies that I think some are really overstated and that it's a bit much by the NBA, but some that's, you know, quite real and just missed time. like, I don't watch Ja Morant anymore and go, this is one of the most valuable pieces in the NBA. You know, if the Grizzlies are in fact shopping him and they're trying to rebuild or retool on the fly, like, I'm sorry, but even the fact that they would have Ja Morant in rumors should be telling to you of what they think of him as a player and as a franchise leader. I genuinely, you know how I feel about Emmanuel Quickley. I'm not the biggest fan, but I don't view going to Ja Morant as this unbelievable upgrade that puts you in the championship mix, that if you were moving off Quickley and then adding a bunch of other assets, including first round picks and stuff, like, I don't think that puts you anywhere. I think that just makes you even more confusing. Ja Morant, Brandon Ingram, Scotty Barnes, that I don't know. I don't know what the hell that is. That's three guys who I want to have the ball and who have not accomplished anything as individuals. Like, I personally don't like it. Same thing with the DeMontis Sabonis thing. It's like, are they really in it? Okay. Like, I could kind of see how we would fit in a reality if you just get them for very little. You buy extremely low. If you were to flip them for RJ Barrett, I would say, okay, yeah, you do that. But more assets going out? Yeah, I don't know about that. The Kevin Durant thing, like them being so obsessed with Durant, Giannis Antetokounmpo is still lurking out there. Why would they be in on all these guys? Like, that just seems like a team desperate to do something for the sake of doing something rather than having a real vision. That feels like a team that's potentially trying to move off of players and pieces before they are diminished in value. Like, I don't get any of this. If I'm the Raptors, the path is very clear. See this group play out. See what you have with these players. Maybe move RJ Barrett in a trade. Like I said, if you can get some kind of RJ Barrett Sabonis type of a deal where maybe you throw in some future protected first, fine. But yeah, like upgrade on that spot, okay. But why wouldn't you want to be keeping the powder dry for a Giannis trade? Why wouldn't you want to see these players go out on the court, play together, give them some run, and see what you have and store your assets for something that actually makes sense for your organization? And again, I don't think that they're even in on Ja Morant. I think that that's like kind of fool's gold. I think, again, a lot of this is just the books assessing a team that's been involved in trade rumors, an organization with a president that has made big splashy trades before, and throwing names out there. I don't think this is like the most credible thing, but I just will say from the outside, and even when talking to people who know more about the Raptors' inner workings than I certainly would, that the kind of consensus keeps coming back of like, there's a lot on the table in a lot of different scenarios. And it makes me a little nervous. It makes me a little nervous for a team that didn't make the playoffs last year in a watered down Eastern Conference. Yeah, they played some scrappy defense. They beat up on a bunch of teams that were also tanking down the stretch and blew their lottery position. I've said it before. I understand why they would want to move off of the 9 pick or dangle that as an asset if they feel like they're out of range for a guy or two that they really coveted and they thought that they really wanted. Like, some mock drafts have them taking, Derek Queen. And I'm like, all right, I guess. But yeah, it doesn't feel like the most Raptors-y player. Doesn't feel like a perfect fit as a rookie. Yeah, and if they don't love that spot and they can get an actual roster piece, sure. But this feels too indecisive for me. This feels a little too desperate for me. Hey, will somebody please come here? Hey, can we get somebody? Can we get a name? Can we get some excitement? It just doesn't feel like what a Masai Ujiri would actually really want to do, which is when he was really building this team out. It was like, hey, got rid of Gravis Vasquez at the right time and he drafted well. Hey, they grabbed a good undrafted free agent. Hey, they developed through their G League. Remember how everyone was talking about how the Raptors were so much at the forefront? I was actually thinking about that watching Siakam in the finals going, hey, is this guy the best G League story that we've ever had? Guy went down, he won a G League finals MVP. He was coached under Jerry Stackhouse. He came up slow. His responsibilities with the Raptors, they started off as like, oh my God, he's starting, because it was that weird Luis Scola year. But man, he developed his game slowly over time. And then when Kawhi left, he was handed the keys to the offense. It was like, okay, now you can be the guy. And we experienced the growing pains of that but he's ultimately someone who now is getting almost 30 points in a road finals game against the best defense in the NBA. This does not feel like really any organic growth. It just feels like a mismatch of, okay, well, we're just trying things out. We're throwing things against the wall. And I'll say it for the millionth time, I don't think that the Raptors are an organization that can throw draft picks away the same way that some of these other teams can. If you're the Miami Heat and you're throwing them in a trade, it's like, okay, cool, you're going to sign somebody. If you're the Los Angeles Lakers, cool, you're probably going to be able to sign somebody. Even Houston and San Antonio, like with what they already have in terms of the depth of their assets, you feel as though you're going to be contenders to sign somebody because you've got Wemby. And yeah, I'm sorry for those of you that don't think state tax matters in other leagues. It absolutely does. It absolutely does matter to these players. So these next few weeks are going to be fascinating for the Raptors. They really are. Like, what is the actual truth? Does it lie somewhere in the middle? Are we getting too extreme with this stuff? But what in actuality is the plan? Because I like being opportunistic. Who doesn't? I like the idea of, hey, a star became available and you pounced because you thought the price was right. That's the one thing I can't quibble with the Brandon Ingram trade. Is, do I like the move? No. Did I find it confusing? Yes. Did I find it was like a strange time to depart from what seemed to be a rebuild for a guy that has a lot of injury concerns and who the rest of the league didn't want? And that's why the price dropped so low? Sure. But ultimately, you can't get too upset at trading one Pacers first round pick for Brandon Ingram. So opportunistic, okay. But the stuff with Kevin Durant does not feel opportunistic. That feels like you're entering into a bidding war for a 37-year-old who doesn't change the ultimate ceiling of your team, which is to win a championship. Anyways, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. You can reach out anytime. Subscribe to this podcast, leave 5 stars. It really helps the show. Before I take the break, I want to just touch quickly on the Marner conversation that we had yesterday. Yes, there's fatigue, and I really don't want to do too much of it, and this is part of the reason why, is that the post that we put out as a show went viral. Like, a lot of people commented on it, and it was very classic where it was half of you calling Marner a baby and making it too personal, and then the other half being like non-Leaf fans going, well, it's because you're toxic fan base, or some of you even self-hating Leaf fans who are like, it's because the media and the fans. Okay, I want to make this very clear. I actually have no problem if Mitch Marner is mad at the media or the fans. Do I think that we've been particularly unfair with this guy? I don't. I think that Matthews has started to take a lot of criticism, but like the Matthews criticism and Marner haven't been the same. When they signed their original contracts, Matthews was scoring a ton of goals. He had more 5-on-5 goals than anybody in the league. And Marner's was shocking. And it was shocking to see the way that he played it out and handled it, which was like, yeah, that small, it was a short holdout, but it was still a short holdout nonetheless. And it was a local kid who got an unprecedented RFA contract, especially not as a goal scorer. And from that point forward, there was this feeling of like, what, why, what, what's happening here? How did he get so much? Oh, all the RFAs are going to get this. No, they didn't. No, Mikko Rantanen didn't get that. So the fan base lost a little bit of connection to Marner. Marner could feel like he was just doing business right by him. That is his right. The fans have been critical of him. He hasn't shown up in big games. He had the Montreal series where he flipped a million pucks over the glass and he no-showed. He'd always shown a lack of accountability. I think he's been called out for a lot of those things fairly. Are there fans who take it too far? Are there fans that are losers that DM people and tag them in tweets and take personal attacks? Yeah, of course. That's every fan base. This isn't just a Leaf thing. Look at Edmonton, the stuff that Skinner's wife put out there. Like, that's every fan base on earth right now. When things go poorly, there's always idiots that you can find on social media who have access to you. So yeah, I don't blame Marner for that. If Mitch Marner listened to my show all the time, if he was a daily listener and he felt like, hey, you're a jerk, you speak of me way more with my failures than my successes and look how good I've been and all the things I've done, I would go, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I'm not sorry. I'm doing my job and I'm doing it to the best of my ability. And I'm not trying to make it personal with you whatsoever, but yeah, I've never once gone like, I want to go after this guy. Oh, I'm not happy. That's not who I am. And I don't think that's who a lot of media people are either, by the way. I think that there's a couple guys out there that they try to create narratives a little bit more that I don't think are based in. I think that they're based in entertainment, that they're trying to be engaging or whatever. But for the most part, I'll say this till I'm blue in the face. I don't think the media is that harsh. And I actually don't think that the fans are that harsh. I think social media just sucks. If you look at anything, anybody right now, you think Pacers fans aren't turning on Tyrese Haliburton today? I guarantee you, out of the thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of tweets that have been put out in this finals, how many of them have been like attacking Shai Gilgeous-Alexander for free throw merchant or attacking Tyrese Haliburton for the game that he had last night? Like, that's just the reality of the platform. You want to have a greater discussion about who we are as people when we get a keyboard to hide behind. Yeah, sure. But in terms of like drawing or extrapolating something about what this says about Toronto, I think it's too much. But either way, the point remains. If Marner was upset with Leaf fans and media, I would go, hey, there's some basis for this. I get it. And so when I said, what is he so mad about? And so many people ended up twisting it. And I'm guessing that the vast majority of people who post stuff like this, they're not even listening to the show. They got no idea. They just see me and they're like, oh, he's a loud idiot. Who cares what he has to say? Whatever. What I don't understand that he's mad about is not the fans or the market. That is fair. What I don't understand is why he could be mad at the Maple Leafs and why there always seems to have been this underlying frustration with the organization. The stuff of like, well, why does Matthews get that? It's like, because he's better than you. What do you want us to say? He's better than you at hockey. That's why he got more stuff. He's the captain because he's better than you. Is this hard? Well, I didn't get the... Oh, God. Look at all the stuff you have gotten. Again, unprecedented restricted free agent deal. A team that was trying to negotiate with you year over year. A team that... And people are like, they hit me with this one too. They're like, because I said that they never asked to trade him. They never pushed to trade him. They're like, what about this year? What about the famous trade request? Yeah. They let him live in peace, basically, up until the very last minute where they were trying to tender him a contract extension and go, hey, what's it going to take to get things done? What's it going to take to get things done? He's like, I don't know. Let's see how it plays out. And good for him. I don't mind that. But then you can't say, like, the organization wasn't year over year throwing him in trade rumors and, hey, entertaining this. And, oh, we're hearing Mitch Marner. It was like, no, Brendan Shanahan every year. Oh, we're bringing him back. Kyle Dubas. We can and we will. We believe in these guys. I'll stake my reputation on these guys. Blah, 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 blah. That, nobody gets that treatment who's accomplished less. And you can say that about all three of those guys, but I'm just saying this has not been a difficult ride from the organization. They gave you the money. They gave you ice time. They gave you your line mate. They gave you tons of power play time. Like, what did Mitch Marner not get here? They used you in advertisements. Like, you were viewed as core. Like, what? And he earned a lot of this with his play, being a spectacularly good hockey player. But what did the organization do? That's what I want to know, is like, why is he mad at the organization? What did the org do to Mitch Marner? How is the relationship fractured or splintered or in any way in not an A-plus place, given all of the things the Leafs have done in that relationship? And if you want to say like, well, asking him to waive is no move, again, miss me with that. That makes no sense. If you're someone who's going, hey, well, the business is Marner's playing it smart, then if he's this Mr. Business acumen, then he should be able to understand pretty clearly and plainly that, hey, if the team is that you're trying to get you to the negotiation table can't get you to the negotiation table, is at the 11th hour and they want to know what the future is, that they would conduct business, which is to solicit offers from the league for what they would give up for you. Like, that's obvious. And then I get the question of, well, how do you know he's mad? Well, tell me all the other guys that are not negotiating with their teams up until July 1st that play there. Like, who's doing that? He goes to Darren Ferris. You mean the agent to Sam Bennett? Where all we're getting is reports that he and the Panthers have somewhat of a framework, but the number has to come up a bit. Like, this is different. When the Leafs can't engage someone on a contract extension, like, yeah, even if they both know he's not going to be here, it's weird. It seems as though he's made up his mind that he wants to go and take these offers and he wants to leave, which again is totally fine. Do not blame him for it whatsoever. But yeah, it seems okay. Let's say I use the wrong word, mad. Why is he upset? Why is the relationship fractured whatsoever? What have the Leafs done to this guy to result in this type of relationship? I haven't had that answer to me. And that certainly has not been answered by he had a trade request, or sorry, he was asked if he would waive his no move at the deadline and his wife was pregnant. And he just took that as an insult that was too far. It was too much to forgive that insult, sir. Give me a break. All right, let's take one. Quick break, come back, hit what we missed. All right, Armin, what did we miss?
Bunk, yesterday, Team Canada named the first six players on their roster for the Olympics in Milan next year. They were Connor McDavid, Sidney Crosby, yeah, Nathan MacKinnon, Braden Point, Sam Reinhart, and Cale Makar. When you looked at that list, was there like an obvious, you're like, oh, that guy's not on the list? And do you think it's actually important for the team when they get together? Like, is it known amongst them that, oh, this was the first six that was selected?
No, I would guess that there's a level of pride that comes with it to a degree. Like, I don't think that it matters to Sidney Crosby. Like, of course, you have to show him that respect, but do I think that right now he or Nathan MacKinnon, for example, who are not playing in playoff games, are like, hey, man, we were the first six named. Like, whew, sick, huge. No, they just kind of knew it, and I think it was pretty obvious. Here's what I would say. Reinhardt is obviously the name that is the most interesting because he is the least good of all of those guys. He's the least important. If you would have told me that he was not in the first six, I would have gone, yeah, all right, that makes sense. So let's just go through this quickly in terms of like, well, who else could it have been? I don't even, here's how I can tell you it's really not that important. I don't remember who the last six guys were, but I do think Marchand was one of them, right? I don't know. You don't
give
have to
me
Google
a sec. I'll look that up.
Yeah. See if you can find it. It's not a big deal if you can't. Okay, let's just go through it. The goaltenders. Well, they're obviously not going to name any of them, including Binnington, because I think that there's a lot to still be settled there. You've got some veterans, like I said, of the Brad Marchand ilk. I would say fringier, but still the Mark Stone ilk of like guys who are on the team. Let's put Drew Doughty in that mix of Hall of Fame players who, yeah, I don't know, maybe they're just not there because maybe Marchand's too old next year. Like, I don't know. I would guess that these guys, or a lot of them would be there, but I don't know if Drew Doughty's going to be there. Like, I don't.
So okay, it was the same first six for Four Nations, subbing out Reinhardt for Brad Marchand. So you were
That's what I thought. Yeah, that's what I thought. So it's like, okay, they removed Brad Marchand because of his age, which is fine. So who's the guy that you most think should have been there? And my answer to that would be like, I don't know if there necessarily is one. Like, I don't know who should have been there. That, like, Sam Reinhart's playing in Stanley Cup Finals again. He's
Sam Bennett?
Mark? That's the thing. Reinhart's the far more accomplished regular season player than Sam Bennett. Like, Sam Reinhart is more of a lock for Team Canada than Sam Bennett, regardless of the play that he's had. Do I think Sam Bennett's making the team? Yeah. I don't think you want to leave that guy home. My only point here is that Canada has a lot of depth of players. They've got a lot of really good guys, but I don't think that it was like they had to name Josh Morrissey. It's like, okay, over Reinhart, I view them as like a same category of player. But they went with a guy who has put together some incredible regular seasons and who is now in his third straight Stanley Cup final. Like, I don't have any issue with it, that's for sure. But I also just look at Canada's roster and think you've got some core guys that are coming up age-wise that I do think are going to fight for roster spots, right? Like Celebrini. Uh-huh. I would be pretty surprised if he doesn't make the team already. Genuinely. Like, that's how good this kid is. Do I think that they would have going to make him one of the first six? Like, no, they're trying to honor some of these guys. But yeah, it's like, you can't make Konechny or like Sorelli. Like, I'm just trying to think of guys off the top of my head.
Shea Theodore.
Yeah, yeah. So I think Reinhart was an appropriate one, and I don't read too much into it. I would say, actually, honest to God, mm-hmm. if there was like a real notable guy that didn't end up getting put there, it would probably be between Morrissey and Mitch Marner. Those would be the two guys that would say, hey, why wasn't I the sixth guy or whatever? I don't think either of them care. But Marner was one of the team's best players in that final.
Yeah.
And I think he probably views himself as one of the best six players from Canada. So he probably... I did this now. He would probably be the only guy that I would look at and say, oh, maybe he was a little annoyed by this. But yeah, I don't know. I got no gripes with it. All right. What else?
Right before we wrap up, the finals are almost done for the Stanley Cup and the NBA. By next week, this time, we're going to have Blue Jays baseball and, you know, a couple other sports, but it's obviously going to die down.
We're going to have the NBA draft, the NHL draft, and
true
NHL
free agency. We have a couple weeks of news still,
we're not,
I guess.
We're not slowing down yet. Yeah.
When we get to the dog days of summer, I want to start a new show. This is not groundbreaking, but I never watched Trailer Park Boys growing up. Okay. Saw it in passing with my friends or whatever, but I never locked in. Is it too late as a damn near 30-year-old to start Trailer Park Boys?
No, it's an excellent show. What I would say is that I think it's the best Canadian show ever made. I'm trying to think, like Schitt's Creek was really good. I'm a fan of Kids in the Hall. I'm sure I'm forgetting something and someone's going to get so mad at me about this, but I really like Kim's Convenience. I thought that was excellent. But yeah, I think Trailer Park Boys is the best television show we've ever made. It was the funniest. It had the longest run. It resulted in movies. It had crossover success in the United States. Not like that matters, but it did.
Yeah.
Because I just think it was so unique and so good. I think like you can put the first like five or six seasons of Trailer Park Boys up against just about any comedy series and it'll hold its own. It's like you can discuss it. I don't think it's as great as, say, The Office. I don't think it's like South Park, but man, it's in that upper echelon. It definitely, when they got that second run from Netflix where they like exploded into the States, it felt as though it got a little watered down. They tried to do too much. There was this weird season where they brought in Snoop Dogg and Tom Arnold. And I don't know. It personally felt to somebody, it's like anything, you know, you watch a band and it's like your indie band and not like they were some small thing. It was, I remember when I was in high school, we would have poker nights that were built around watching the new episode of Trailer Park Boys. I had a Bubbles t-shirt, you know, in high school. Like, this was not like, oh, wow, you were so hip to watch Trailer Park Boys. Everybody was watching it that was my age. My point is just like, it was kind of our Canadian thing, and then it became something else. And yeah, just, I don't think that it aged particularly well in terms of as the series went on. But no, I think you would enjoy it. I think it would hold up. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what Gen Z humor is. Like, would you like, no, you guys are the generation that's like, The Office, the people from The Office are like, we couldn't make this show today because all the Gen Zs would get offended. So I don't know if this would offend you or not.
Yeah, I can't speak for my whole generation. No, I want some Canadian Tire references, buddy. No, it's just even just being on the show with you the last couple of years, Bunk, or whatever it is, just listening to a lot of pods, people reference it so much and the references don't hit.
Yeah.
And so I want them to hit. And that's literally why I'm going to watch it, you know?
Yeah, listen, I think you should absolutely watch it. And I think that you should report back and you can give the Gen Z report on what you think happened with Trailer Park Boys. But like, I would guess that you have not seen many, like, have you seen Sopranos?
In passing, again, not like.
Yes, in passing is not, you know, so yeah. Yes or no. Okay. I'm going to make this very simple for you. There's no such thing as watching Sopranos passively. People are upset listening to this. Did you watch The Wire?
First season. And then I stopped.
So no. And again, Can I tell you something, though? I'm not mad at you for that, because when I tried to watch The Wire for the first time, I was in university.
Yeah.
And I tried to get through the first season. I thought it was boring. And then my friends were like, what's wrong with you? And I watched it again. And I was like, oh, no, this is genuinely it's either the best or the second best drama they've ever seen. Like that. This is what I'm jealous of you, because
it's like you've a fresh perspective.
Oh, my God. No, it's just that there's probably so many incredible shows like that you have not seen.
For sure.
You have no idea.
For sure.
Because you've been watching. Can you give us some examples of television series that you enjoy? Like
Breaking Bad, one of my favorite.
Okay. Again,
no questions
asked. Fine, but The Wire and Sopranos are so much better than Breaking Bad that I think it's insulting to compare them whenever they get put on lists together. But anyways, go on.
Okay.
Don't be cool with it. Just tell them the truth.
I'm more of a movie guy, if anything.
Okay.
So I'm trying to think through here.
What do you think is a funny show?
Funny show.
Yeah.
I don't know why I have to think so hard about this.
Yeah, man, because you're trying to be cool. You watch Big Bang Theory.
When I was like living at home, like
TV. Yeah, I knew it. You're that kind of a guy. I knew it.
I watched it with the parents, like when I was 16.
Oh, it was just because of the parents. You're like the boyfriend who's like, I only watch reality TV because my girlfriend puts it on, but then you sit there through the entirety of an entire season of it. Like, it's okay. Here's the thing. I should just be giving you an entire list of like 100
television.
Dude, it's
so intimidating. No, that's the thing is, dude,
it's
with
so
shows.
It's intimidating to watch
TV. It's like, there's like 50 episodes. It's like, brother,
again,
this is my whole summer. Should I just cancel my entire travel plans and just watch
who
TV
says
shows?
That? No, listen, of course not. You got to get out in the world. But when you're at home and you need to fire something up and you get your downtime, it's like, yeah, you chose Big Bang Theory with your parents over Sopranos.
So Jersey Shore was one I watched growing up. That was
embarrassing.
Big. That was really yeah.
I don't even know how that's possible, because again, Jersey Shore came out when I was in university. So you're talking like not the first season.
I think I was like 13 when it started. That sounds right. Yeah.
Hey, you know what? For the audience, if you've never seen what Armin looks like he does look like a guy who is inspired by Jersey Shore. He does.
I bought
he has the
D's
attitude.
Spike gel.
Yeah,
I gotta
he
say.
Has the attitude and carries himself and wears the cologne of someone who would watch the Jersey Shore. That's so your generation is like, I'm overwhelmed by television. It's no, you just start at the top with classics. It's the same thing with I would say that my generation was raised on more premier prestige TV. Mm-hmm. Like we had HBO and we got these, it was like, okay, cool. These are what the great dramas are, whatever. But like your excuse of being overwhelmed by this is like, is as though I said to people older than me, like, well, I never watched Taxi Driver because I was overwhelming to go through all the classics. I didn't watch Godfather because it was just overwhelming. I couldn't sit down with it. It's a 3-hour movie.
Prison Break is another big one. I got to say, I've watched all the way through. Love.
Yeah.
That
again,
one.
You have horrific taste, like truly bottom of the barrel. Like you're under the barrel. You're not even in the barrel. You're underneath the barrel trying to seep through the bottom to get inside the barrel. That is you. Anyway. Yeah. You can start with Trailer Park Boys, but we're definitely getting you on Sopranos and, yeah, at least The Wire. Like I think there's like, I hate when people do that. You have to watch it with television shows now, because you're right, there are so many people have so much different taste. I think there's a lot of stuff watered down. But if I had to make a list of like, hey, what are the shows that you had to have watched and that you have to watch that still hold up, I would say The Sopranos. I would say The Wire. I wouldn't put Trailer Park Boys in that, even though I do think that like as a Canadian it probably jumps up the list a bit more. Mm-hmm. I would say South Park, even though that is overwhelming because it is so much and there's probably so many historical events from that show that you would know nothing about that wouldn't resonate with you. But yeah, South Park would absolutely unquestionably be there for me. And then this is going to be a deeper cut, but yeah. I do think that it is like pretty damn near mandatory viewing if you were just going to ask Deadwood.
Really?
Yeah, Deadwood. Deadwood. Yeah. That would be my four. That would be my four horsemen of the you need to watch these shows. Anyway, all right, let's wrap this up. Again, subscribe to the podcast. I'm off tomorrow. I'm off. It's a Joe Carter classic. Weird because it's after the NHL potentially wrapping up finals, but I'm off tomorrow because of the Joe Carter Classic. But yeah, we will see you on Thursday.